This weekend starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. Geico has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to geico.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
Compass Media Networks. This is America's First News. This weekend with your host, Gordon Deal.
The Twitter phenomenon. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Kashinka in for Gordon Deal on this New Year's weekend. Happy New Year. And here's what we have for you this hour. President-elect Trump used Twitter to get his message across in 2016. Will he do the same in 2017? The Great Depression happened a long time ago, but it's still affecting the way we eat. Toy companies want you to play their games, so they're trying to make board games go viral. And a manifesto to end boring work meetings.
People spend a lot of time wondering how other people are judging them or reacting to them. They also tend to sit back and maybe blame other people for nothing getting done rather than taking charge themselves and moving ahead. So there's a lot of sociology there that interferes with getting things done.
Sue Schellenberger of the Wall Street Journal will be along in about 20 minutes with some tips on how to improve the dreaded work meeting. Donald Trump broke a lot of news on Twitter in 2016. Will that trend continue after he's sworn in? Natalie Andrews of the Wall Street Journal has written a story called Five Predictions for Political Tech and Social Media in 2017 and joins us now. Natalie, how will Twitter be used by politicians and their staffs?
You know, we are still seeing Donald Trump break news on Twitter, and he has said he will continue to use Twitter as a medium. He often says that he can't trust the media, and so he will continue to use Twitter. So it will be an interesting time, I think, in 2017 to see how he uses social media to break news.
What about other politicians?
You know, I talked to Spreadfast, which is a social media monitoring analytics company, and they think that Donald Trump may encourage his cabinet to use social media in the same way. You know, President Obama, his social media tactics, he encouraged his cabinet and agencies to join social media, and they did, and they often used the White House as kind of as they followed the White House's style. And, you know, the Donald Trump's cabinet may look to Donald Trump in much of the same way and say, well, we will follow the White House's style, and, you know, we may see all sorts of new ways of breaking news in the next year.
Natalie, your story mentions online activity and says it will become more partisan next year. Why is that?
You know, this came from a study from the Erickson Lab. They polled people from all over the world and found that people are creating their own silos on social media. People are finding their people and really sticking to that. And they are really finding their people, sticking with their own groups and not really expanding their horizons.
That's a little scary in terms of the future of the country and how we're going to come together, isn't it?
You know, he likened it to how we move to a neighborhood and we talk to our neighbors and we meet our neighbors and we talk to our neighbors and we don't maybe expand our horizons beyond that. He said it's maybe not a negative thing, but that's what's happened in real life and that's what's happening online.
We're speaking with Natalie Andrews of the Wall Street Journal about how people will use social media and how politicians will use technology in 2017. Will online platforms be used for forming groups and fundraising?
I really think that what we are seeing is only the tip of the iceberg. A lot of this organizing is happening in secret, and then when we see it emerge, it's been organized, people have raised funds, and they've used social media to grow, and when they emerge, they've become organized, and they've use social media almost in secret to get strong first, and then they come out and they're stronger and more empowered. And Facebook allows people to create secret groups. People create email you know, in secret and different things like that. And then they come out in public stronger, more organized. They've fundraised. People are already talking about Donald Trump's policies and how they might need, you know, on the progressive side, people are worried about cuts to health care. People are worried about cuts to Planned Parenthood, different things like that. So on the progressive side, people are kind of prepared for a fight. But people on, you know, Donald Trump's side are also prepared to support Donald Trump and are arming up on that side as well. So people are already getting ready for that fight, and they are organizing. And I think we're seeing that in secret, and they'll emerge very organized. And we're going to see that play out as well.
One other big thing that happened in 2016, or at least came to the forefront, is fake news and fake news stories that emerged everywhere. How are real news organizations fighting back against that?
You know, one thing we're seeing is that real news organizations aren't shying away from writing about conspiracy theories or stories that are going viral on fake news sites. They aren't hesitating to debunk these things before things that fake people might, you know, say, oh, that's a story that's like floating around there on some conspiracy news site. We ignore those things. Now, real legitimate news sites, they write about these things and they say, hey, this is being talked about. We're going to vet this. We're going to say, hey, this is wrong and this is why. And they're bringing that to the forefront and they're showing you why it's wrong. And I think that's a shift. But it is an important shift, and it's an interesting one, and it's probably a good one because they're not letting these theories run rampant on their own. Because the way Google works and the way Facebook works, these things, a legitimate news story and the fake news story can almost trend side by side, and so it's important that these things almost be debunked so they can't run side by side.
That's Natalie Andrews of the Wall Street Journal. Jennifer Kashinka sitting in for Gordon Deal. Happy New Year weekend. Back in October, an Oklahoma newspaper endorsed Hillary Clinton. The News and Eagle and Enid lost 162 subscribers because of that decision, and the pain is still being felt. Manny Fernandez, Houston bureau chief for the New York Times, has the story. Manny, why was the paper's endorsement of Clinton such a shock to many?
You know, Enid, Oklahoma, this is northwestern Oklahoma, very conservative town. It's a very conservative part of the state. And the editorial just kind of took a lot of the readers by surprise. You know, it's an editorial board that had endorsed different conservative candidates over the years, endorsed different, Republican presidents. And I think it just took a lot of people by surprise. It sort of worked a lot of the residents. It stunned them.
Is the loss of 162 subscribers a great deal for this paper?
It depends on how you look at it. In some ways, it's a bigger impact than at a larger paper. They lost nearly 2% of their subscribers. It's a 10,000 circulation daily newspaper, and they lost 162 subscribers that they know of. These are the people who actually said the reason why they're canceling their subscriptions. And I think that does hurt, you know, nearly 2%. For a small-town newspaper at a time when, you know, all newspapers are trying to keep every subscriber that they can, I think it's hurt them a little bit. But they say they will survive, and they're definitely pushing forward.
Manny, what about the impact on advertising? That could perhaps be even more significant.
You know, I think so. Yeah, there were 11 advertisers that pulled their ad. At least one of them was probably one of the biggest accounts at the paper from a funeral home, and a couple of others did too. I mean, it's sort of hitting them in the bottom line. You know, what was interesting about it is that all this wasn't an organized effort or campaign. This wasn't other people didn't call other people to say, hey, let's do this. This was just kind of a lot of people in town getting together and saying, you know what, we really don't like this, and I'm gonna pull my support for the paper, you know, as far as the bottom line goes. And that's what's sort of interesting about it. This wasn't a campaign by any means.
We're speaking with Manny Fernandez of the New York Times. Now, of course, other papers on both sides of the aisle made some controversial editorial decisions in this very contentious election. Why do you think this one has lingered so long now into January?
Well, I think because it zigged when other papers zagged. You know, I think that there are a lot of big city papers that endorsed Hillary, and it was kind of no big deal. But in a small town like this, to go for Hillary, they really took a step out from the tenor of the community, and they stand behind it. You know, they're unapologetic about it. But I think that, you know, it's sort of when you zig when others zag, they sort of stuck out a little bit.
We talked about this in the newsroom all through the last year. Does it really make a difference whether a paper or a media outlet endorses somebody? Does it have any impact on voters at all?
Well, you know, it's funny because in this case, it did not have an impact as far as changing people's minds, you know, especially a lot of the residents there. You know, I don't think anybody picked up the editorial, read it, and said, you know what, I'm gonna vote for Hillary now. You know, it didn't work that way. But as far as an impact, as far as people assuming that it would have an impact, that's when it did have an impact. You know, one of the journalism professors I talked to says they may have had a lot of canceled subscriptions, but I can guarantee you that they're being read, you know, and I think that that's maybe some of what was happening there is they wanted to be read and they wanted their sort of controversial stance, you know, to be noticed. But yeah, I think it does have an impact. I think it has more of an impact than people think.
Okay. And Mandy, with some newspapers and media outlets, of course, struggling monetarily, do you think endorsements will eventually become a thing of the past? Or as you just said, it does attract a certain amount of attention and they'll stick around?
I think they're going to stick around. I think the tradition is there, and the tradition is sort of set in the media. And it's kind of like, you know, when you're a reporter and you're out interviewing somebody, you ask for their age. It's just one of those age-old journalism traditions that goes back, you know, way back in time. And I think it's like that. It's just a tradition that is probably not going to die. You know, it lives on online, and I think it's going to stick around.
Thanks, Mandy. That's Mandy Fernandez of the New York Times. It's 21 minutes after the hour. Jennifer Kashinka on this New Year weekend, sitting in for Gordon Deal. Hope you're enjoying it. If you've been in meetings where nothing gets done, there may be a reason for that. There may be too many people there, or maybe even not enough. Sue Schellenbarger of the Wall Street Journal has some tips on how to run an effective work meeting. Sue, what's the problem with an oversized group?
The problem is that people spend a lot of time wondering how other people are judging them or reacting to them. They might decide they really don't need to do anything because there's so many other people there that they can pass off the responsibility to others. They also tend to sit back and maybe blame other people for nothing getting done rather than taking charge themselves and moving ahead. So there's a lot of sort of sociology there that interferes with getting things done.
What about too many people, too much talking?
That's really the problem. Many meetings are too large. Managers invite people for good intentions. They don't want to offend anyone. They want to get diverse points of view. But the group takes on too much weight to really be efficient. And as a result, the outcome is never reached. It's a really common problem, and many managers aren't aware of it.
So if you're trying to generate ideas or have some kind of brainstorming session, isn't it better to have more people involved?
That's a common perception, and in one way it is. You want diverse viewpoints. You want people who can bring different perspectives and networks of people to the meeting. On the other hand, research shows we generate our best ideas when we're alone. This is not widely known, but it isn't really the brainstorming session that makes us be creative. It's time to think alone and come up with ideas when we're not worried about others judging them or thinking that they're foolish.
Should every meeting have an agenda, and how hard is it to stick with one when there are a lot of people?
Oh, every meeting should always have an agenda, and you know there should be a time plan, limits on discussion, a decided outcome in advance. Too many people easily pull the meeting off topic. The meeting leader just has a much harder time typically trying to get everybody to focus on what needs to be done. So, all of those pieces need to be present for a good meeting.
Okay, is there some kind of sweet spot for the number that should be in a meeting?
There's usually when you're just discussing a problem and trying to identify potential solutions, 4 to 6 people, 4 to 7, same thing for a decision-making meeting. The reason for that is everybody needs a role to play. You know, you may need someone who brings long experience and wisdom, somebody who has the necessary information, say, to make a decision. You may have people there who need to hear it being made so they can take word back to their teams, and you need people with a stake in it who actually decide. So you really need everybody to have a role, and the role you don't want is a spectator.
With so many people working from home these days, are there dynamics different when people are on the phone calling into these meetings than they are when people are speaking face-to-face?
In meetings, some managers told me they believe need to be even smaller when they're being held at the teleconference or video conference. It's harder to control people, to keep people on task, on an agenda. There's a bigger burden on the meeting leader in virtual meetings to draw people out, make sure everybody participates, and make the meeting move along so everyone pays attention. So, it's with so many people working remotely, not even from home but in other offices, this is a big challenge, and leaders really need to have skills to make it come off well.
And Sue, in all the research that you do for your columns, is this one of the most kind of dreaded things in the workplace, a meeting?
I can't tell you how much grateful email I get and how much frustration people voice. People don't think too much about whether a meeting is going to be helpful or not. We're taught to collaborate, and collaboration for collaboration's sake happens a lot of times, which means you call a meeting when you don't really need one. So this is a real problem in the workplace today, and there's some very good minds working on it to try to cut out wasted time. Bain and Company estimates that 4.5 out of 11 hours frontline supervisors spend in meetings is time when they didn't really need to be there for one reason or another. So it's a pretty big deal.
Thanks, Sue. Sue Schellenbarger of the Wall Street Journal. It's 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend, America's First News.
America's First News is online all the time. Follow us on Twitter at This Morning Show. Like us on Facebook or send us an email. This morning at CompassMediaNetworks.com.
Jennifer Koshinka in for Gordon Deal. Happy New Year. Hope you're enjoying your holiday weekend. Coming up in about 20 minutes, how toy companies are going viral. It's been nearly 90 years since the Great Depression, but those tough financial times have had a huge impact on one area of our lives today, the way we eat. Joining us to talk about it is Adam Chandler of The Atlantic. Adam, how did government's role change when it came to feeding the nation?
It's very complicated. The argument in government was whether or not they should help people in terms of giving them relief. And that's a question that we still argue about today in terms of how much money should the government be allocating for hunger and for food stamps and for social projects. But all that started with the Great Depression, and that's just one aspect of it. Another aspect of it is the way that government is involved in instructing people on how to eat. You know, Michelle Obama is famous for her Let's Move campaign and for telling people, maybe switch out the kale chips for potato chips and things like that. But that starts at in the wake of the Great Depression, which is interesting because people were really needing instruction on how to make everything work on limited resources and limited available food.
How did the government become involved early on? Was this something that people favored, or were they forced to do it? How did it come about?
What's most interesting about this is that the situation almost demanded it. Herbert Hoover, who was president, was adamantly against government intervention in any sort, either sort of telling people what they should be doing or spending any money, and he was thrown out of office. He won election by one of the biggest electoral landslides in history, and then was 4 years later removed by an even larger margin by FDR. And a lot of that was based on whether or not government was going to play a bigger role in helping people through the crisis and acknowledging that there was a really big problem. So that's sort of how it started. And from there, Roosevelt had experience when he was governor of New York working with relief programs on the state level. And so that experience kind of led him to make it a national project.
Your article also mentions that the nation started to steer toward fortified food, and the way we ate really changed from the farm to some more basic things. Can you talk about the menu changes?
Absolutely. Well, the Great Depression is absolutely not known for its cuisine. This was really basic sustenance. And so the government was telling people, on the radio and through these really well-funded initiatives, you know, hide your vegetables in these casseroles, make sure you use a lot of dairy, basically just trying to make sure that everyone had enough of vitamins and nutrients. And that's sort of the beginning of nutritionism. We talk about nutrition labels now. We talk about how much fiber we should get, whether or not we should eat or drink certain things. And that all sort of began at that moment where people were unsure of what they should be eating. There was a lot of misinformation out there, and there was a lot of illness because of what was available to eat. And so the government took an active role in sort of deciding how to set guidelines and to try and push citizens to be a little bit better about what they were doing. It wasn't always the best advice, but it was sort of a comfort to people who kind of needed it.
Thanks, Adam. That's Adam Chandler of The Atlantic. It's 22 minutes before the hour on this weekend, America's First News. Self-driving cars are on their way. Will they kill car companies? This morning's Gordon Deal has the story.
We're speaking with tech analyst Rob Enderle about his piece called How Self-Driving Cars Will Kill Car Companies. All right, meaning what, Rob?
Well, so the big backstory on self-driving cars, and particularly if you look at how Uber is positioning against the opportunity, is that we won't need to own cars. And car companies aren't set up for a market that where most people don't need to own cars. In that market, instead of having hundreds of thousands, if not millions of customers, you might only have three, the companies like Uber that buy self-driving cars. And the reason for that is when we go to self-driving cars, basically, we'll have them flowing around the neighborhoods, and when you need one, you'll call for it, and it'll come pick you up and drop you off. Unlike a taxi, the self-driving car can be always ready, always on the spot, and can respond much more quickly. Plus, it works pretty much 24/7. And when it's not in use, it'll depot someplace that you don't need to provide coffee and donuts or anything else. They just depot someplace and they can be charged. And if you look at the kids coming into market that are coming up around Uber, they've decided not to get driver's licenses. Which once again, we're so far away from the ideal we'll have with self-driving cars, but already in urban areas, kids are saying, "Hey, Uber's good. Yeah. I don't need to incur that expense of a car for a fraction of that. I can get to where I want to go. I don't have to worry about maintenance. I don't have to worry about gas. I don't have to worry about parking. Somebody picks me up, somebody drops me off, and I'm good, and I can use all that extra money to buy other stuff." And I don't think the car companies have fully grokked that means that they go from being one kind of company to a very different kind of company, and maybe that different company doesn't build cars. I mean, both GM and Ford are looking at getting into the shared ride business with their own efforts. But if you think about it, you know, airlines don't build their own airplanes, and Boeing doesn't fly commercial airlines. They build them. So there's a hard separation between the companies that build things like trains and airplanes and the companies that provide them as a service, primarily because that there doesn't seem to be any economies of scale between the two. You just can't get big enough to justify building your own planes, trains, or ships for the most part. So that means that whatever we have now as car companies are going to be very different when we get into the self-driving car age, and many of these car companies may no longer be around.
We're speaking with tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal of the Enderle Group. His piece is called How Self-Driving Cars Will Kill Car Companies. You know what I never considered, too, when I was reading your piece, how cars that we own or lease or rent most of the time just sit idle.
Yeah, you're wasting a ton of money because I mean, I've got four cars. One of them I don't drive more than 150, 200 miles a year. It really is the case that during the night when your car could be working, it's in the garage. Yeah. While you're at work, it's in a garage, and you're often paying for parking, and it's aging. I mean, it's not like it's that restful period is making the car last that much longer. It could actually be working during those times and earning money, and a self-driving car will be. since most of them are likely to be electric at some particular point in time, they'll be like roll-on appliances, and they and that means you can get a for the same amount of money, you get a ton more work out of them, and that's why a company like Uber will be able to, you know, afford or make better use of the cars that they have than you'll be able to.
Thought it was funny too. You said by 2030, right? Just what, 14 years from now, the only folks in the U.S. still driving will likely be those that have a gaming system and a VR rig.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Because you'll be in the car and you'll be on the gaming system and pretending you're driving the car. You know, the way that the self-driving mechanisms are being designed now, it's a theory called, or it's a process called guardian angel, and that means that if you want to drive, it'll look like you're driving, but the self-driving car is really controlling the car, and if you do it something stupid or incorrect, it will just simply disconnect you. Well, you'll actually be disconnected. It'll just simply do what it's supposed to do, and so you'll be much more like that little kid in the car seat with the steering wheel. You'll think you'll be driving, right, but actually the car is driving you. You're not driving yourself at all.
Tech analyst Rob Enderle. It's 13 minutes before the hour. Happy New Year. Jennifer Kashinka in for Gordon Deal. He will be back on Monday. How do you update a board game? You make it sync with the smartphone crowd. Janelle Nanos of the Boston Globe is here with a look at a new way we're playing games. Janelle, what's the YouTube effect?
We're speaking with tech analyst.
The YouTube effect is that game companies are now designing games with YouTube in mind. They're hoping that players will pull out their smartphones when their friends or family make a gaffe or a goof, and that they will record it for posterity and post it on the web. We're seeing a real trend right now in terms of games getting some real traction on Facebook and YouTube videos, and game makers are now starting to design games with that in mind.
How did this all start? Is there one thing that we can point to?
The game Pie Face hit the web last year pretty hard. It was a really fun YouTube video that actually appeared first in the UK, and it was a grandfather and a grandson playing a game. You know, it's a pie in the face game. It's a little hand that flips up after you turn a knob a couple times, and it'll flip whipped cream in somebody's face. And the grandfather and grandson were just having such a blast playing this game, like collapsing into giggles, and it just went viral. It got millions of hits. And Hasbro, the game maker in Rhode Island, started getting calls about the game, and they basically acquired the rights to produce it here in the States and distribute it globally, and it was the best-selling game of this year. It sold out Christmas season last year, and it's been reissued this year as a new Pie Face Showdown. So you can put two heads in the little frames, and you can kind of guess who's going to get pied in the face. So they've seen real traction with it, and they're definitely starting to think about viral play patterns as something that they're looking for now.
So basically people are kind of embarrassing themselves and putting it out there?
Oh, yeah. The other example that's really gone really viral are these mouthpiece games. They're essentially dental cheek retractors that you use for either teeth whitening or I think perhaps braces or other things that dentists might do to your teeth. They pull back your gums and lips to make you look a little bit like Predator. And people were getting them just kind of, I think Melissa McCarthy had actually worn one in her movie, The Boss. And she and James Corden wore them during an interview that she was conducting to promote the film. And a lot of people saw her do that and were looking for them online. One of them was a comedian in New York with a really big YouTube presence. His name is Joe Santagato. He found the dental cheek retractors on the web, bought them, and just basically created a game with his family, sort of like a Taboo style game where, you know, they came up with a bunch of really sort of silly phrases and put the mouthpieces in and tried to say them and guess what people were saying. And Hasbro was watching these videos really kind of pick up on the web. I mean, Joe Santagato posted his video. It got 3 million hits overnight on Facebook. And so they actually reached out to him and they said, will you help us promote a game that we're going to make, you know, based on this idea? You know, the Hasbro folks were driving all over Rhode Island looking for dental mouthpieces, and they were able to basically, in a matter of about 10 weeks, bring this game to market. It was actually one of about a half dozen games that, you know, all center around this mouthpiece.
So it's a whole wide world for anybody with a silly idea. We'll try to get some traction from this, right?
Well, yeah. And the marketing person there told me that he doesn't even think of any toy right now without thinking about, can it be played on YouTube? What's the demonstrative effect there?
Thanks, Janelle. That's Janelle Nanos of the Boston Globe. Well, if you believe most people on Twitter, Facebook, and other social media, 2016 was the worst year ever and one to forget. But CNN has put together a list of some of the good things about 2016, perhaps some things you forgot. So here are some of them. In the world at large, there's finally peace in Colombia. A pope and a Russian Orthodox patriarch met for the first time in 1,000 years. In the U.S., the high school graduation rate has never been higher, while the teen birth rate fell. The unemployment rate is the lowest in 10 years, and we gave to charity more than ever before. In health, there's hope for a new HIV vaccine. Researchers found new genes that may help cure ALS, thanks to money raised by the Ice Bucket Challenge. And West Africa is Ebola-free. In conservation, the tiger population rose for the first time in 100 years. Pandas are no longer endangered, and Hawaii has the largest protected space on the planet. And in sports, the Cubs finally won the World Series, Cleveland won the NBA crown, and the Olympic refugee team won our hearts. That'll do it for this hour. I'm Jennifer Kashinka. Thanks for listening to This Weekend, America's First News.